everyone, welcome back to the Towards Data Science podcast after our little summer hiatus. It is wonderful to be back here, and all the more so because of the conversation that we're about to have today. So, deep learning models, transformers in particular, are defining the cutting edge of AI today, and they're of course based on an architecture called an artificial neural network. And as their name suggests, artificial neural networks are inspired by the function and structure of biological neural networks, like those that handle information processing in our brains. So it's a natural question to ask, how far does that analogy go, right? Today, deep neural networks can handle an increasingly large range of skills that historically would have been unique to humans. Skills like creating images or using language, planning, playing video games, and so on. So could that mean that these systems are processing information like the human brain too? Well, to explore that question, we'll be talking to J.R. King, a CNRS researcher at the École Normale Supérieure, affiliated with MetaAI, where he leads the Brain and AI group. There, he works on identifying the computational basis of human intelligence with a focus on language. And as you'll see, JR is a remarkably insightful thinker who spent a lot of time studying biological intelligence, where it comes from, and how it maps onto artificial intelligence. And he joined me to explore the fascinating intersection of biological and artificial information processing on this episode of the Towards Data Science podcast. I'm really excited to talk to you. I first came across your work on Twitter, as one does. You had a really fascinating thread about this kind of comparison between the way that the human brain processes information and the way that AI systems, kind of larger AI systems, things like foundation models, process information. And this is just such a rabbit hole. It's something that I think everybody's kind of thought about, but no one really dares to kind of sink their teeth into in the way that I really am excited to do today. So first off, thank you so much for coming, and I'm really excited about diving into this. I want to ask you kind of a situational question, just so people understand, like, what even is this space that you're in? What is this topic that you're chewing on? And like, what do the questions look like that you're trying to solve day to day?
Right. So originally, I'm from cognitive neuroscience, and cognitive science for a while was really sort of the intersection between many disciplines. There was psychology and neuroscience, and AI was already there a long time ago, but perhaps it was not as popular as it is today. And I think the general theme is to understand the laws and the principles that guides reasoning and thoughts, especially in the human species, although that's not the only species. And when AI reboomed in the last decades or two decades even, this intersection became between neuroscience and AI became really, really a front of research to try to really understand whether the algorithms that were developed by research engineers and by people really from the computer science community were in any kind of way similar to the functioning of the brain. And so at the beginning, I think many people in cognitive science were very skeptical of even asking this question, because after all, it's just algorithms. They just process zeros and ones at the end of the day, which is perhaps very different from how the brain processes data. But I think now it's becoming quite clear that the similarities are really quantifiable and start to make sense. So that's sort of the general field that I'm in, is really to try to intersect neuroscience and AI, better understand the laws of learning and the laws of information processing.
Okay, great. Well, I think that's a great intro. And it's helpful for, I think, listeners who don't have a neuroscience background. I think most people are going to be like me here, where, you know, they know about AI, they have an understanding of maybe, you know, what a foundation model is, what language models are, but like, not necessarily the neuroscience. So can we start there with this, like, this mapping between the two? So in my head, and I look forward to you correcting me, but in my head, we have artificial neurons, and feeding into artificial neurons are a bunch of weights. And we think of these weights as something like the synapses, maybe, that are in real biological networks. And then we have this kind of like mixing process where the weights define how much of each of our inputs are going to get mixed together in our neuron, and that gets passed along. That's about where my understanding of the mapping ends. So what am I, first off, is that right? And second, like, what are some of the interesting things that picture might be missing? What are some of the important differences as well?
Yeah, I think that's the right first approximation. So you have especially so you have many types of AI algorithms, but the most popular ones are deep learning networks, and deep learning networks are indeed vectorial systems. So they do process information, which in as an input takes a vector or a tensor, and will combine these different dimension by using these sort of weights and stacked with nonlinear functions, and they do this repeatedly. And I think most of your audience will sort of know, have sort of good intuitions of what's happening there. But the key point is that deep networks, at the end of the day, the way they process information, not talking about learning for now, just take a deep net which has been trained. When it processes information, it takes an input, like an image or a sound or a text, and it translates or transcribes this input into a vector. And this vector will be transformed by a series of operations or by a series of layers, ultimately to produce something that we think is interesting. Like, I don't know, in the case of translation, we want to produce the same sentence in a different language. In the case of vision, perhaps we want to translate a series of pixels into a label and so on and so forth. So the point is that when you have a deep net, you transform an input into a vector of activations. And when we have healthy volunteers that come to the lab and gets their head scanned while they are watching images, we are also collecting vectors of activations. So when you go in an MRI scanner, so this is the big tube that you typically see in hospital, you can lay there and watch images, and basically there is a really cool technology behind it that allows experimenters to identify which brain region is being activated by a given image. And we can do this measurement in many, many places. And so these are all the sort of what we call voxels. And you can think of these are different dimensions of activations that are
like a pixel for volume.
Each end. A pixel for volume, yeah, a voxel.
Okay.
In the case of MRI, but we have different technology. And the point is that when participants watch images or listen to sound or read text, this sensory input will be transcribed by brain responses, which also look like multidimensional activations. And so we have two systems. We have deep nets on the one hand and human subjects on the other hand, who can be processing the very same input. And in both cases, we can collect high dimensional activations vector specific to those inputs to try to see whether they are more or less similar to one another.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I think it does. So what I should be picturing here is I've got this vector, this kind of list of numbers that I get from my deep neural network, usually somewhere in the middle, maybe, you know, we have a representation of something interesting. And then in the brain, the counterpart to that in the brain is, so I need to be thinking about a bunch of different voxels, these little chunks of brain tissue, and how much they're activated. And that list of activations for all those voxels, that's the analog roughly for the list of activations for the neurons in an artificial neural network. Is that's the comparison?
Yes, in practice, this is the comparison that we do, but obviously these voxels are not necessarily, they are these voxels, they collect or they aggregate activations from hundreds of thousands of neurons and sometimes millions of neurons. So it's really sort of a coarse approximations of what's going on here in the brain. But to try to make this very concrete, we know, like from early work, especially from Nancy Kanawisha at MIT, that we have specific areas in the brain which are specific to faces. If you present a face, whether it's in, I don't know, the top right corner or the bottom left corner, or whether it's a happy face, a sad face, a young face, or an old face, you have some areas in the brain which will systematically get activated. And so you can think of those areas as containing neurons, and therefore the voxel that we measure will respond every time that there is a face. And in deep nets now, especially in visual deep nets, of course, we know that they are dimensioned, they are artificial neurons which specifically respond to faces as well. And so we can try to see, okay, for those two, do we find that they actually get they respond to the same type of content in images. And for this, we present the same images to humans and to the algorithm and try to see whether we can find this match between the activation that we record in the brain and the activation of the deep net.
Okay, very cool. So this is starting to answer the next question that I had kind of coming up to the brim here, which was, how do you prove to me that like that a brain responds in a, let's say, a similar way, that the firing patterns of, say, clumps of neurons that show up in these voxels in the brain are similar to the firing patterns of artificial neurons in an artificial neural network? What are the metrics that you might look at there?
Yeah, so that's a good question, because I think the key challenge to be highlighted here is that we have dozens of thousands, sometimes more, voxels that we collect from each individual subject, and at the same time they are sometimes millions, sometimes even more activations or artificial neurons in a deep net. And so of course we're not going to investigate every one of these artificial neurons or every one of these individual voxel in the brain, because it would be way too tedious, and potentially we could, just cherry pick if we're just doing it
right.
Like this. And so the way by which we approach a problem is to try to formalize the approach. You say, okay, let's try to do some statistics on that, and let's take a training set where we'll try to find the best match between the activations of the brain and the activations in the algorithm. So we find our match, and for this we can use basically it's linear algebra in most cases, and we can also find a deep net to try to do this mapping, but generally speaking it tends to be just based on linear algebra. So find the best way to predict the activation of the brain given the activation of the deep net, or vice versa. And then on a test set, we verify that we can predict above chance. So with new images, or with new text, or with new sound, we see whether the brain responses to those sensory inputs are predictive of the activations in the deep net, and vice versa.
And it's interesting, you said predictive of and better than chance, which invites kind of this next question. Obviously, anytime you do work with wet tissue, like a brain, noise is going to be everywhere. And I just remember from my horrible days doing biochemistry back in undergrad before I switched into physics, thank goodness, I had to do experiments like this and everything was just crap. It was just a bunch of noise. So how do you get, like, what kinds of signals do you get? How clean are the signals? With what level of confidence can you make these claims? Can you speak to that a little bit?
So there are two questions. So the level of signal, I think, is highly controversial, and perhaps I should answer the second question first. So the second question is how confident we are about our results, and there it's we can use statistics, and we can say, okay, when we repeat this operation on every image that every subject looked at, or on every word that subjects listened to, we get basically a lot of samples. And when we compute statistics, we can compute standard sort of p-value based analysis and say, okay, we are confident because we think that a chance would have explained that result with a likelihood of 10 to the minus 10 or something. I mean, the type of result we work with now, because we work with very large data sets, the p-values tend to be very, very small. So we are confident that there is a mapping. Now, the issue of the amount of signal that there is here is a bit more controversial. So the reason why it's controversial is because, unlike physics experiments, or even to some extent chemistry experiments, it's never possible to truly repeat the exact same experimental condition twice in the same subject, and in particular with text or with sentences. So if you listen to a sentence once, you will process it, and your brain will try to identify, okay, which word is going to which with which words. I mean, if we believe syntacticians, and you will construct a gist of the meaning of the sentence. And when you repeat the sentence multiple times, you will not try to reconstruct the sentence the same way. You will just say, okay, I know this sentence, I've processed it before, and therefore I will not engage the same computation, the same resources. And so, if you repeat twice the same sentences, basically you don't get twice the same activation in the brain. And that's an issue to estimate the signal-to-noise ratio, because that means that, unlike many other domains of experimental sciences, the repetition here is very difficult to... we don't have true repetition. So what we can do, we have proxies. We sort of try to go around it. We say, okay, if we take all the subjects as baseline models, can we predict a remaining subject, or these sort of things? And sometimes it works, but sometimes we see that these so-called noise-seeding experiments, they're actually not as good as what we obtain when we map a deep net to the brain. So that suggests that the noise-seeding is lower than the actual signal that we can collect, which sort of paradoxical, just suggests that basically this noise ceiling is not a noise ceiling. So anyway, so the point is that without going into too much details, the assessment of noise is very difficult to make, but it is clear that noise is coming from a lot of different kinds of sources. Yeah. Physiological noise, so when people breathe, you have artifacts, right, which is due to breathing. Cardiac rhythm can create artifacts as well. Movement, chewing, eye movement, all of these can corrupt the signal to a high extent. And so it's we can try to remove all of the ones that we know of, but it's clear that there are many others that we do not master. Perhaps just one anecdote, right? Just one anecdote. For instance, something that people don't tend to correct for. When you are laying in the scanner, your brain is a bit squishy. And so just because of gravity, basically the brain does not have quite the same shape because of gravity, sort of get compressed in the direction of your weight, basically. And when you go in a different scanner, like in magnetron cephalography, you will not have the same position. And so we will not compensate for that. We just consider that the brain has is sort of a rigid solid and we don't change that. So there are many of these noise sources that we don't control for and that are very difficult to exactly know the amount of signal that we are collecting.
That's really remarkable. It makes it all the more remarkable that you actually got an effect size that was high enough to be very confident in what's going on here. Were you surprised by the outcomes of this experiment? Because one thing that struck me, you know, when you talk about, we talked about the analogy between neural networks and brains earlier. We said, okay, we have these artificial neurons and we have these biological neurons. But then we made this leap where, in the context of this kind of experiment, we're not talking about comparing artificial neurons to biological neurons and their firing patterns. We're talking about comparing artificial neurons to like a voxel, like a clump of biological neurons. And apart from all the noise that just comes up in the brain system, this seems like a pretty significant disanalogy, a pretty significant difference just between those two framings. Were you surprised that difference didn't add up to something that would like completely screw everything up? Like, were you surprised that despite that difference, you still see this kind of mapping?
So before I mention or discuss the surprise, I should state the result. So not only we do find a mapping between the deep net and the brain, but this mapping is highly structured. And I think this is the most, at least that was the most striking thing to me from the beginning. What we observe in this latest study by Juliette Millet and Charlotte Cocheteau, who were PhD students at the time, is that the first layer of the transformer of a deep net trained to do speech processing correspond to the first area of the brain, of the cortex, I should say, that processes a speech. And the deeper you go in the network, and the more the activations of those deep layers corresponds to higher level areas in the brain and the prefrontal cortex. And so it's not just that there is a mapping and statistically we can quantify this, is that the organization of the computation in the deep net and in the brain seem to follow a similar architecture. Okay, so whether is this surprising? So if you were to sort of do a thought experiment and ask the same question or make that prediction 10 years ago and ask the community, I think many people in the community would have said, nah, it's not going to work. These algorithms have nothing to do with what the brain does. I remember when I was in undergrad that my AI teachers were really stressing the point that we called these algorithms artificial neural networks, but don't think that they are working like neurons. It's just an analogy, it's just a metaphor. Like, don't think it's actually working the same way. There are many reasons why it shouldn't work the same way. For instance, artificial neurons, they have a continuous activation function. Biological neurons, they have a discrete activation function. They either spike or they don't spike. The backpropagation principle used in artificial neural networks, which back in the day were thought to be biologically impossible, although now it's a topic of discussion. Many people think that it is biologically plausible. And so back in the day, I think most people, or maybe not most because it's difficult to quantify, but a lot of scientists in the community would have said there won't be interesting similarities between algorithms and the brain. So from that perspective, yes, it is surprising. I think in our results, we have to be quite modest because we're not the first people who do this comparison. And in particular, the lab of James Sicalo at MIT, but also of Marcel van Gerven in the Netherlands and of Bertrand Thirion in the south of Paris, are different labs who are already as early as 2014 were doing this comparison between supervised deep nets in the visual domain and brain activity, in particular in the rhesus macaque. And they were showing similarities between the two in the case of vision. What we're trying to push in our case is really to say, is this analogy between algorithms and the brain holding for high-level cognitive processes like language and that are typically associated with the cognition of our species?
So that's actually fascinating, partly because of the questions that it then invites about what the nature of intelligence is. I mean, you know, we're in both cases, you know, deep neural networks famously are very hierarchical in terms of their organization. Sort of simpler, without butchering this, and I'm sure you'll correct me, but with simpler concepts or more concrete concepts being represented in lower layers, and as you go deeper and deeper into the network, you get essentially a mixing together of those concepts that leads to fairly intuitively more complex concepts until you get the most abstract ideas at the kind of deepest layers. Does this imply something to you about the universality of that kind of structure? Maybe this is going way too far, but is there something about intelligence that intrinsically kind of is best handled with this sort of hierarchical concept? Or do you think that really what you're studying is a simple mapping to biology? It's one instance of intelligence and we shouldn't read too much into it.
I mean, that's a very deep question. I don't think I have evidence to weigh too much into answering it. What we observe is that two systems as different as DeepNet, trained on sometimes just gigantic amount of data, the kind of data that a human would never be able to process in terms of text, like GPT-2 and OPT and all these very large language models, they use so much data. The architecture is so different from the brain in many ways. When you take the sort of transformer, it's very different from how the human brain is organized. And yet we do find a similarity with one or a few species, if we compare in the case of vision to macaques and to other species. And so we have a few points basically of comparisons, a few elements of comparisons that suggest that we can find similarities. And I think that is, indeed starting to suggest that perhaps there are some universal principles to the laws of processing in this case, as opposed to the laws of learning, which I think is the next question. If you want to learn efficiently, is there really one good solution to that? And my intuition is that there are probably not that many solutions, and that the whole goal for our disciplines, both in neuroscience and in AI, is actually to find those laws of learning.
So you would almost expect on that level a kind of, maybe not full convergence of the two fields together, but a co-evolution that would continue further into the future.
That's again a very hard question. I'm not entirely sure how it's going to play out in the future. I have an intuition that neuroscience and cognitive neuroscience has refocused on analyzing the patterns of brain activity, trying to understand the organization on like which area does what, how faces represented in the brain. For instance, you have work of Fowell and Sao that show that you have different patches actually in the cortex that process faces, and some of them are specific to emotion, some of them are specific to the orientation of the face and in the image. And so they sort of decompose, decipher exactly what is going on, what are each of the computations. Whereas in AI, the way is not so much in the analysis of the results. It's really to try to find the learning principle that ultimately perhaps will create right. all of these structures. But it's really about the finding the right law. So I think they will. My prediction is that there will continue to be strong interactions between the two fields, but the objective may be slightly different.
Yeah, and I imagine, I mean, this is something that comes up anytime I talk, especially in an AI safety context, to people who are thinking about AGI and that sort of thing, where there's this sort of, there was until recently this concern that language modeling would have this like hard cap because all of the data that's produced for language models ultimately is just data generated by humans. And so how could you ever get an AI system that's superhuman if all you're ever training it on is just human-generated data? This kind of like maybe puts another twist on that, where it's like, okay, well, if the analogy between artificial neural networks and biological neural networks is strong enough, maybe that suggests we're bounded somehow by that analogy, that maybe the constraints that exist on human brains might extend then to those systems. I can think of a couple reasons why that might not be true, but do you have any thoughts as to that kind of ecosystem of thinking?
Yes, so I think there are several points. So first of all, I tend to agree that there is kind of a cap in terms of the amount of text which is generated every day, at least the amount of interesting text which is generated every day, and that will be a bottleneck, I predict, for the big language models to some extent. But I would also like to stress that language is compositional by a sense, and we should not think of it as too constraining. You can really express new ideas that are really, really new without necessarily needing a new word for it, just using a combinations of words which has never used in that particular case. So I think that's sort of the strength of language, is that you can, it's very, very fruitful as a material to work with. And so I don't think the bottleneck will come from the modality of language as opposed to vision or the modalities. But in practice, scaling a very large language model, like, again, GPT-3, OPT, and T5, and all these different alternatives, I think they will not scale to many other orders of magnitudes in terms of the amount of data, but there is a clear thing to optimize now, is the amount of tech necessary for them to become powerful. Because when you compare the amount of data they use as compared to the amount of speech, spoken sentences, right, or written text that we process as humans, it's just ridiculous, right? A kid can learn language with something like,
2 million words or so.
Yeah, well, it depends exactly what level of understanding you want your kids to reach. But basically, it's an order of magnitude. It's several orders of magnitude lower than the amount of text which is fed to these algorithms. So clearly, there's something that we missed, I think, and that these algorithms could be improved by.
Well, that itself is sort of another interesting branch of philosophy, neuroscience, and AI, where people will talk about, for example, the role of the evolutionary process in creating almost the hardware that can learn these things quickly. And so, in a sense, and I wonder how you'd react to this, but I can imagine one argument being like, okay, look, it's true that the human brain uses far, far less language to actually get good at language, far, far fewer words that it takes than an AI system to master language. But it's not like the human brain was a blank slate to begin with. It's the end product of a whole bunch of a completely separate learning process that came from evolution that essentially defined an architecture that's so refined for this particular task that all the priors are already baked in some sense. Like, it's essentially like the analog to like a convolutional network for vision. This has been carefully crafted to allow for things like language, and that we ought to count the computation that went into making the brain in addition to the amount of words that you need to be exposed to. Does that make sense?
No, yes, it does make sense. And I've heard this argument many times, but I'm not entirely convinced. So, because I think it's sort of in between just a redescription of what must be and something which I think could be false. So a few elements. So first of all, the genome is very small in terms of the amount of data that can be stored there. It is, I think it's something like 30,000 genes. Many of them will not have to do anything with language. So perhaps we can bake a lot of language processing in this thing, but it's mm-hmm. probably not going to be as big as one would wish. The second thing is that we can argue that the brain has some sort of backdrop algorithm and can sort of use feedback in a very smart way to change all of its weights and adapt accordingly. When you move away from one brain and you go to two brains or multiple generations of individuals, suddenly this learning principle just breaks, right? So it's not that you can co-adapt very efficiently between individuals, at least not as efficiently as one can learn on its own. And so the point is, just to make it something very concrete, right? People from when we evolve, we move from places to places, we change dialects, we lose a lot of information. All of this is a huge amount of noise in the selection process. And
right.
And yet, when you compare languages across the world, you do find these well, at least if you listen to linguists, you do find strong elements of regularities. So it suggests, on the one hand, I agree with your statement that this suggests that there are some key principles that allow the human brain, and specifically the human brain, to learn language. What those key principles are, I think, are still up to debate. The proposal from back in the day were sort of recursive structures and you know, like syntax, the whole Chomsky idea. The issue when it comes to AI.
Can you unpack that? Because I think for people who are a bit less familiar with Noam Chomsky's
right.
work.
Okay, so let's unpack it. So what are the observations? The observation is that the human lineage is, it depends again where we want to start it, but it goes from minus four million years to the last 100,000 years, if we want to focus on Homo sapiens. And when you, And humans, as far as we know, are the only individuals who can process language in the sense that they can generate a sentence which has never been heard before to produce meaning. And this is not something that we observe in any other species, at some few sort of marginal exceptions, like bees, for instance. They can dance around and sort of indicates where the position of flowers is with regard to the sun. But this is sort of very sort of marginal and like a niche kind of thing. But otherwise, language, as we process it, seems to be one of the specific traits of our species. Okay, and our species, in light of evolution, is really just appeared as extremely quickly, right? The development of mammals is something like 116 million years, and Homo sapiens is 100,000 years, right? So it's just in the last second of evolution, suddenly, boom, you have a species that masters language, builds technologies, transmits information and knowledge across generation, builds civilization, technology, and so on and so forth. So clearly, evolution has found a way for the brain to adapt much more efficiently. And the key idea that was put forward by Chomsky and others is to say that the key principle behind it is language, or at least language of thoughts, the ability to represent things in a symbolic fashion and to combine the symbols in a following specific rules in order to generate high-level meanings and to transmit potentially this high-level meaning to other individuals. And so the key idea if you follow, again, the school of thoughts of Chomsky, but this is highly debated in the field of linguistics. In linguistics, they love to debate pretty much everything. But this is one of the pillars of linguistics, is to say that the key idea is that you combine symbols using a systematic operation, which is called merge. And when you do this, basically, you can only construct binary trees. And so all sentences can be described as a binary tree, which we call syntax, the syntax of the sentence. And so the idea behind this is to say, if you have a brain which is able to represent symbols and combine the symbols together in a recursive fashion, because at each node you will redo this operation, then you will have a brain that can do a language and can represent things in a much more complex fashion than it used to. Okay, so that's
sorry, no chance.
Sort of very
so no, I insisted on it, but I love it. I mean, I think it's really important to understand where these ideas come from. Sorry, go ahead.
Right. So that's a very condensed. I'm sure a lot of people would will be furious about my summary of this.
We'll leave your email in the description of the episode so people can send you their hate mail. Yeah.
Exactly. But that's the key idea. But the issue, I think, became and I love these ideas, and I think they are beautiful. The issue is how do you translate them in practice for AI or for computer science in general? A lot of people, Sam Bowman and others, have tried to build deep nets who have sort of a bias towards this kind of compositional operation to try to do things, combine things two by two, and find the best way of combining things two by two in order to produce meaning that would potentially, I don't know, differentiate two distinct sentences that would be similar, sort of things. And in practice, this tended to work, but not much better than just a plain recurrent LSTM-like algorithm. And certainly less now that we have transformers, which is yet another beast in terms of architecture, and that are not really based on this sort of this strong constraint that would come from linguistics. So it's not entirely clear here where we are, because the syntactic structures are there, I think. It's not that linguists invented them. We do see these regularities in individuals, but the architecture that we use in AI do not follow this bias. And we also see that although these architectures are extremely efficient at scale, they use a gigantic amount of data, certainly a lot more than where we are, what we do as humans. And so there is a possibility that we missed. There is something that lacks in our algorithms.
And do you tend to think that? Like, do you tend to think, obviously, central to this debate is the question of whether simply taking the AI systems we have today and scaling them more, throwing more data, more processing power, and more model size at them is going to get us something like general purpose human reasoning. Where, at the risk of having you receive more hate mail here, where do you tend to fall on that scaling debate? Do you think that it's the path, or?
I don't think it's the past, but first of all, I should say that even last year, I would have said, nah, it's a dead end. Don't just scale. But now that I see the latest results, I'm like, okay, clearly I was wrong. I should revise my position. Scaling works. I think it's clear when you see a Lambda, when you see a GPT-3 to some extent. And even when you see DALL-E 2 and Imagen, I think is based on T5 underneath. So for the audience, T5 is also a deep language model trained at scale. And so these algorithms demonstrate surprisingly good, or I should say really remarkable levels of understanding, in a sense that they can generate images that would have never been in the training sets. They can really understand, associate features to different objects and they encode relationships between different objects with very little mistake at this stage. And so, yes, certainly scaling works. Is scaling the only answer? I don't think so, but it's surprisingly better than what I had anticipated.
Okay, no, that makes sense. I mean, I think it's fair to say GPT-3 and broadly the scaling story just took basically everyone by surprise, it seems, including even OpenAI when they built GPT-3. I don't think anybody really expected it to have all the capabilities that it had. But one question that does come up a lot too when we start to look at these capabilities is you have people look at these systems and say, well, yes, it can do super impressive thing X, Y, and Z, but is it really understanding? Is it really thinking? Is it really deeply kind of comprehending these concepts? And there's an interesting debate going on there that I think you'd be in a great position to opine on. I know I saw this in your Twitter thread too. What are your thoughts when it comes to this question of whether AI systems understand things, whether that's a useful term to use, whether it's even an interesting term to think about in this context?
I certainly think it's interesting and useful, but I think most of us in the community agree that it's an ill-posed problem at this stage. We don't have a good way of formalizing this issue. But in terms of question answering, it demonstrates, these kind of algorithms demonstrate remarkable level of understanding, right? They can identify who is the agent, who is the receiver. They can do some symbolic or zero-shot symbolic processing. If you say X equals dog and Y equals cat and Y is chasing X, it will understand or it will be able to predict what is the content of the meaning of the sentence to some extent. In the way, or at least the way by which we think that it understands, is because it can produce the right behavior when we ask it so. And when we do this to individuals, that's the only thing we have, right? We only have behavior. Like, how do I know that you truly understand? Is only by asking questions. I think it's an ill-posed problem at the moment. I hope that in the future we'll be able to formalize it a bit better, perhaps by using analogies, by trying maybe you see I'm not I think I didn't I don't have a good answer to provide because I think I'm typically representative of the fields on that particular issue. My position, however, is that this level of understanding is now very difficult to question because of the of the behavior that these algorithms have. Now, one thing that I would like to stress, however, is that there are different levels of understanding. When you watch a movie, the same movie watched by a kid or by an adult will not resonate in the same way, because we don't have the same prism to read and to watch that particular movie. And so understanding, at the end of the day, is also how you combine this sensory input to how you represent the world internally. And I think it is very clear that there are different levels of understanding that have been already reached by these algorithms. Syntax, I think, is, I mean, if it's not solved, it will be very soon. However, the structure of narratives, which requires a processing of very large amount of text, which is not something directly suitable to current transformers, at least off-the-shelf one, is something which is, I think, not necessarily well mastered, but I have little doubt that it will be in the coming future.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. You talk about this idea of, you know, a child watching a movie versus an adult watching a movie too. Sort of suggests, I'd be curious about your take on this, but like a potential challenge when it comes to almost empathizing with our AI systems, not to kind of use an overloaded term there. But, you know, you think about the ways in which, you know, like a two-year-old is stupider than a newborn, or the ways in which a five-year-old is stupider than an eight-year-old, and so on. The kinds of mistakes that you make as you approach adult human intelligence along that trajectory, they look very different from the kinds of mistakes that we see from other ways of approaching intelligence, including evolution. Like, a cat makes very different kinds of mistakes from an amoeba, and a monkey makes very different kinds of mistakes from a cat. And yet we only have experience approaching intelligence pretty much through those two vectors, either child rearing or evolution. And yet with AI, we're trying to make pronouncements like this thing does or does not understand, where we kind of already know that, I mean, if all you ever saw was child rearing, if all you ever saw was children, you'd be in a really tough spot to try to say whether a cat could understand something or whether a monkey could. It kind of seems like we face the same problem with AI. There's no reason to expect that AI systems would display the same kinds of hints that they are or are not understanding stuff as they improve. It kind of seems like there's no fire alarm. There's no moment where we go, oh, okay, like that's a system that really understands.
Yep, I think you make a very important point here, especially in the domain of ethology. So when you study different individuals to try to assess their level of intelligence in different domains, the typical criticism is the issue of biases. And so people will say, okay, the cat did not understand, the cat is rarely used in experiments that I know of, but this animal did not understand that there was food under this box because it's not really interested by boxes in general. And so people really try to design new type of experiments such that it would be more ecologically valid with regards to the agent. But in the case of AI, of course, it's not clear, right? Because the biases that it has are basically those that exist in the corpora, in the corpuses. I'm not sure how to use the plural form here. In the text that these algorithms are trained with. So it's not entirely clear what kind of biases we should expect or whether these algorithms should be able to not be too constrained by those biases that exist in the text they train with.
Yeah, and actually it's funny because there's this argument that goes that, you know, prompting an AI system can reveal the presence of capabilities, but not the absence of capabilities. And like, we've seen that in the context of GPT-3, where, for example, famously, I think somebody put together a bunch of nonsense questions. They asked GPT-3, like, how many sporkles go into a morgul or something? And it would answer those questions, like a kid just making up an answer on a test. And so people looked at this and they said, oh, well, this is proof that, come on, GPT-3 doesn't understand nonsense questions. How clever of a system could this be if it screws that up? But then somebody later tried experimenting with a prompt that said, you know, this is a conversation between a super intelligent AI and a human. If the human asks a nonsense question, the AI responds with, yo, be real. And they ran that test, and sure enough, GPT-3 answered those nonsense questions with, yo, be real. So just by prompting it in the wrong way, by looking for the wrong kinds of biases, as you're flagging here, we can end up completely missing the plot and thinking that an AI system completely lacks a set of capabilities that it might completely have mastered.
Yeah, I think these examples are terrific, actually, because they highlight a new type of task, which is the art of probing these algorithms. I think what this stresses is what these algorithms are fundamentally trying to do. They don't try to give the right answer, right? They try to give the answer which is most likely given the preceding text. And that's something to really keep in mind, because I think that's very different from what we do in many ways. When we have a discussion, perhaps we also try to anticipate what the other is going to say, but it's not the only thing that we're trying to do, right? So for instance, one thing that we try to do is not necessarily predict every individual word that you are about to say, but to anticipate the overall idea that you are about to express, even though this idea may be expressed by different sequences of words. For instance, if you say the cat is chased by the dog, or the dog chases the cat, each individual word in these two sentences can be different. And so if you were to make this prediction at the word level, you would be wrong potentially all the time. But if you take a sort of a higher or deeper or more abstract level of representation, then perhaps you could anticipate that. But even anticipation is not the only thing that we do. For instance, we try to do control. So when we have a conversation, but in fact, in any kind of situation that requires intelligence, we're not just observational individual. We can try to say, one of our objectives is to say, I would like to guide the person to do this or that behavior. And that's not what GPT-3 is trained to be, because this kind of algorithms is just trained as a passive observer. And so I think it's very important to highlight that they are really core. It's not just a GPT-3 does not understand X or Y, or it failed on this particular math test, is that fundamentally it tries to predict what's the most likely outcome. It's not trying to generate a behavior which is going to maximize another type of value.
And actually, it's funny, this has so much overlap with a lot of the conversations we have about AI safety on the podcast, where, you know, this idea of these systems having objectives that are slightly misspecified. They're not quite what we want them to do. They're importantly different. And as systems become more capable, those differences start to become clearer and clearer. Do you see overlap then between this idea of like optimizing language models with their objective function being more tailored to that kind of, I guess, helpfulness goal, and the idea of AI safety maybe more broadly?
So for AI safety, I don't think I'm the right person to, I don't think I would have very interesting things to say, but with regard to the previous one, so for instance, the idea of predicting the next word given the context seems extremely arbitrary. In fact, it is an objective that has been criticized many times, especially before language models started to really take up speed. And what's remarkable is that even though this task seems extremely arbitrary, it's extremely useful to learn other things. Like, for instance, people have shown that if you just train an algorithm to predict the next word, you will be able, in the middle layers of the deep net, to recover syntactic structures. You will be able to find an explicit representation of analogy in the sense that syntactic structures and analogy can be read out by a linear system. Just one layer of neurons would be sufficient. If you plugged it into the middle layers of these deep nets, you will recover this information. And so what's remarkable is that this simple and seemingly arbitrary objective was sufficient for other forms of other structures to emerge and to be learned. And so I think that's really, at least for me, that's the take home, right? There are some laws that seem very distant from what we would think as being helpful for intelligence, and which nevertheless, because they scale, which nevertheless allow the emergence of intelligent behavior.
Absolutely fascinating. Okay, I have one more question that I really wanted to ask you, and I couldn't figure out how to segue it in, but damn it, I have to ask this question. Okay, this is super speculative, but it has to do with brain-machine interfaces. And maybe you can see where this is going in terms of the research that you've done. But it just, when I saw your Twitter thread, when I looked at the paper, I couldn't help but wonder, you know, like when you look at a deep neural network that has, you know, a layer at which we have a certain representation of an input, and that input seems to correlate really nicely to behaviors that we see in the physical human brain. Is there a sense in which we could map those two together physically? Is there a sense in which we could use this kind of understanding of the way the brain processes information to build more kind of sophisticated forms of brain-machine interfaces? Is that super ridiculous? It could be, but I'm just curious about that possibility.
So it depends exactly what you have in mind, but if the question is, can we use the mapping between deep nets trained on a particular task, like image processing or language processing, and the brain, whether this mapping allows not only to better understand how the brain functions and how the deep nets functions, but also would potentially allow for decoding brain activity, or to sort of have a technology which allows one to do to transcribe brain activity into something which is meaningful. I think this is certainly the case, and this has started in several labs actually. So people start to use brain imaging, which they align with pre-trained deep nets, and to regenerate the images that people are likely to see given their brain activity. At the moment, this is mainly working in the context of sensory processing. So typically when people watch images, it kinds of work when people are trying to convey something. So when they think about an image, but the signal-to-noise ratio here tends to be reduced. So there are a few key challenges. So this has also been done with patients who have electrodes inside their head because of clinical reasons. Typically, it's individuals who suffer from epilepsy. And you can record brain activity and again try to see whether you can decode these brain responses to allow the individual to, I don't know, write text on a computer screen. There's been two or three studies in the past year that showed that individual patients can generate text with this kind of approach. So brain decoding is something which is possible. The issue is whether it's, I think, to some extent, scalable. So for intracranial recordings, to me, it's only relevant, and it's already high importance, but it's only relevant for patients who have intracranial recordings, which is an extremely invasive technology, and therefore implies a huge amount of health risk for the individuals. Again, the reason why these patients have these electrodes is not to do this brain decoding thing. This brain decoding thing is just a side research that has nothing to do with the reason why they have an electrode inside their head. But for healthy individual like you and me, I presume, it's a bit more difficult because brain non-invasive decoding, non-invasive brain activity is much harder. The signal-to-noise ratio is lower, and perhaps more importantly, the setup that we use, so typically the MRI data that we use, is collected in this magnetic ring, which is huge and makes mind reading in this case only possible in a very controlled experimental setup and not with sort of a wearable device. So I think the big frontiers for tomorrow is to try to see not only whether it's possible in laboratory condition, but whether we can also push brain decoding thanks to this alignment with deep nets in conditions that are basically scalable and more practical for everyone.
Well, absolutely fascinating. JR, thanks so much for joining me for this big exploration of what turned out to be so many different exciting topics. Is there anywhere you'd recommend people go to follow your work, either kind of your musings about random things or your research in particular?
So I'm part of the FairLab at Meta, so Fundamental AI Research. The lab has a blog which shows the work of all the research, not all, but a selected portion of the work which is done in the lab. Most of the studies that are done are published on, or at least they put on archive or bioarchive servers. And otherwise, for me personally, I tend to advertise our latest work on Twitter, that's pretty much it.
That's a follow I can very much recommend. Well, JR, thanks so much. This is a very fun conversation.
All right. Thank you very much, Jerry.